This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Today's program was recorded live at the Two River Theater in Red Bank, New Jersey. People always ask me, especially at my age, I get a lot of age-related comments now. They always ask me, who would you like to work with that you didn't get to work with? And I always say, William Holden and Barbara Stanwyck and Cary Grant and, people like that. And and people who are of my own generation, give or take, I admire some of them, but there's not a lot of them who I think I'd crawl over broken glass to work with, you know. But there are a few. There are a couple of people who their career and the work they've done and the way they've lived their lives in addition to their careers has always been so just inspiring is the word. You know, there's not many of them, you know. And one of them is the gentleman I'm going to introduce, is someone I've admired my entire life. When I first came to New York to go to school in 1979, soon thereafter, you know, there's the Paul Davis posters of this guy playing Hamlet in New York. This was you wanted to be this guy. You know, he was like one of four or five people that this is you wanted to have a career like. So please welcome Kevin Kline. Now, what was it that was in an interview I read that you said there was the guy from Juilliard the fencing, he taught you how to use a walking stick, and they taught you an Elizabethan bow.
Yes.
And what's the other kind of bow he taught you?
Any kind of bow. Well, I learned a bow in every single period. Restoration, post-restoration.
Would you show us a restoration bow? Pick one that's your favorite.
Well, let me see. Restoration. I'd have to go back to my notebook.
Let's have the applause again, and go!
I remember this bow. This was like, I don't remember the period, but I thought it must have been very silly.
My favorite, someone told me that Olivier had a bow where he'd come in and he'd take in the house right, and then he'd come over and take in the house left, and then he had what he called the crush of humility. The crush of humility. In your voice training and so forth at school and beyond, what is a St. Louis accent that you got rid of? How do people in St. Louis talk?
Ooh, I thought I didn't have an accent. I thought, well, St. Louis is very neutral. But what they do at Juilliard is when you get there, the day you arrive, is they tape you saying a bunch of sentences. And then at the end of the first year, they play it back to you. And you start screaming in horror at how regional you sound. And Edith Skinner, who wrote the book, which is the textbook used by everyone that I know, every drama school. And one of the students said, "Edith, when I went home at Christmas, all my friends said I sound affected and phony." And she said, "Change your friends."
Now, when you grew up, your dad, I mean, all the bio is there in the interwebs everywhere. That your dad owned a music store and he was an opera singer, he was a trained singer, and you describe your mother as being a very theatrical character, quote unquote.
Yes.
But was she an actress?
Never.
Never.
No.
But she was very colorful.
She was very dramatic, of Irish descent.
Right.
And Aaron Gobrow.
And you went to Indiana for music.
Yeah, I went there to study music. 2 years. And then I realized the degree of mediocrity I had achieved. What?
You were more like your mother than your father? You're more an actor than a musician?
No. No, I was a terrible actor. But I thought, this is hopeless. I could see my whole future before me, and it was utterly mediocre.
Musically.
I said, you'll
be... Were you in a band?
Oh, in high school, I was playing rock and roll, which is part of the problem when I went to study serious music. I had spent too much time playing sock hops and bar mitzvahs. Rock and roll was my was my demise. I could see that I wasn't. I'd started too late, and I didn't have the discipline. And I thought, well, what's he?
Did someone tell you you were talented as an actor?
When I started doing plays in the theater department, all my musician friends would say, "I saw you in the play. You should. That's really good. You should do more of that." And when I would play the piano for my theater friends, they'd say, "You're really good. You should really stick with that." So I actually had to decide myself, and from very humble beginnings, I started doing small parts and worked my way up. In the theater department.
What was theater and film in your childhood? Meaning, were you, writing poetry and you were very sophisticated when you were young, or were you watching McHale's Navy like the rest of us on TV?
The latter, I'd say.
The latter.
Yeah. No, I wasn't. I went to movies. I did not go to the theater much until I was in it.
Huh.
Really, in college, I saw a lot of theater. But it was movies. I always wanted to... I remember, well, not always, but maybe toward the end of my high school, thinking, "Gee, I'd like to do that. That looks."
Did you really think that you wanted to do that?
Yeah, yeah. Because, this was in the '60s when being cool was everything. You know, you had to be like Paul Newman in HUD. You had to be cool and heartless, and I had mastered.
Did you say
that.
Heartless?
Heartless.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see HUD?
I saw. Yeah.
Yeah. Heartless.
Roll down the window, Hood.
What was it? Melvin Douglas.
Melvin Douglas.
Melvin
yeah.
Douglas.
But he was an idol. But anyway, I was so cool, and I thought, oh, I could never be an actor because I feel nothing. And I remember my first acting class at Juilliard. I mean, I'd taken some acting classes in college, but I remember, did you ever do those emotional recalls?
Of course.
Yeah. And they say, okay, yes. I want you to recreate a time when you were really, really angry. And I said, I've never been angry. I've never been angry. That's the first part.
You're going to have to give me a minute here.
The fact, yeah. Angry?
Now, did you... But how did you go... I mean, because obviously people to this day think of Juilliard as this great... temple of arts education, and how do you go from Indiana and you're not sure you're an actor? How the hell did you get into Juilliard?
I asked myself the same question because
your whole career a huge accident? Is it like this?
Pretty much.
No.
But yeah, what happened? No, it is. I think chance comes into it quite a bit, and being at the right place at the right time, because I joined Juilliard in the third year of the 4-year program. That year, they decided we have thrown so many students out and so many have left in desperation that we now have like 12 actors left out of the original 35. We need to fill out the class. So they brought in David Ogden Stiers and me and Mary Jo Negro to fill it in. And they brought me in because they told me, said, we need a leading man because we have all these character actors. And then they gave me character parts. Really, because the part of the training was to be the complete actor and to play character roles and leading
Were you
men.
Frightened when you were there? Did it scare you at all? Was it intimidating?
Yes. And yes and no. I'd done it for 2 years. Well, I did it while I was in music school. That was part of the problem. But I did it heavily my last 2 years of college. And was actually part of a group that we formed our own company off campus and had our own theater. And night and day, I was doing a play in the main stage at the University Theater and also working at this little coffee house theater doing satirical political reviews every week and improv. And we had a playwright and we started doing his plays. I had confidence. I didn't really deserve it.
You didn't come from nowhere. I mean, when you got to Juilliard, you'd done some theater.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and so when you're in Juilliard, what do you... I mean, this is a kind of a lazy question, but what did you take away from that? What are your memories of what it did for you? What did it do for you?
Well, it certainly polished me. I mean, you asked me what my St. Louis accent was. St. Louis has a kind of lateral, those are fantastic pants you're wearing, man. Those are fantastic pants.
Yes.
Those professional, they're trousers, they're not pants. You learn not only how to pronounce the words correctly, yes. but what are the correct words.
We would never say the word fantastic. Yes. Those are brilliant trousers you're
yes.
wearing.
Yes, wonderful. But they, the verse, how to parse verse and break down a Shakespeare scene before it breaks you down. And a lot of movement. I was very, very, very tight. I was an athlete in high school, and I could, catch balls and things like that, but I couldn't, when I was acting, I was very stiff all through college. And I would say, I don't know what to do with my hands, all that, And Juilliard, suddenly they said, well, now you will come first thing in the morning with a leotard and tights. And I went, oh, no. No, I don't do leotards and tights. I don't. What? And sort of modern dance kind of movement with Anna Sokolow, who was a student of Martha Graham's, a brilliant choreographer and an amazing teacher. And so anyway, the short answer is I learned to loosen up physically and become more disinhibited physically. And now people say, you really move your hands a lot. Like a European actor. Anyway, that's beside the point.
But
it loosened me up and it polished my speech and it made me appreciate Shakespeare much more. And listen, any great conservatory, whether it's music or drama or dance, it gives you a protected place to practice your craft. And protected, when I say protected, I mean it's never more competitive once you get out as it was then. And getting up in front of the class to do a scene is much scarier than an opening night on Broadway. But it is protected and you learn by doing it.
Is it, for how many people here, clap if you're studying acting now or you had studied acting? So there's a few people. When you were there, did you was it very production oriented? Did you do shows?
Yes.
Because when I went to NYU for the brief time I was there, like a year and a half, it was the opposite. They were like, you are nothing, and you don't get to do shows to the fourth year. You are nothing.
Yeah.
Lay on the floor and just breathe for 3 years. Practice breathing. Not very production-oriented, but was...
Juilliard is exactly the same, but I missed those first 2 years.
You missed those lying on the floor years.
By going into the third year, it became really production-oriented. Costumes, makeup, sets.
Yeah, you were Oberon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Whole play, you were assigned a role, and you did it. I missed those days. Before then, you did something in a studio with maybe a prop, but it was just about acting, pure acting, and I missed all that.
Now, when you got out of there, what was the gap between that and doing the soap opera? You left Juilliard, and you were on the soap opera how long? 3-4 years?
Oh, God, no.
No,
no, no. No. I was in the acting company for 4 years, which was a company... I was in the first graduating class of Juilliard.
Right.
John Houseman said, I just can't bear the idea with all this training that we've given you that you're going to go off, all of you are going to go out and do soap operas or do sitcoms or movies.
Credit card commercials.
Credit card commercials. Podcasts.
So.
Whatever. So I'm going to form you into a company. And he formed us into the acting
right
company.
Right out of the Juilliard.
We were handed equity cards and put on a bus and we went and did the 4 plays that we had done in rep in our senior year and toured the country. I did that for 4 years, during which John Houseman won an Oscar for The Paper Chase and then started doing sitcoms and commercials and all the things he forbade us to do. So I got out of the act. Forced myself out of the acting company. Said, I've got to face reality and learn how to really wait tables, and do what actors do and pay my dues. Meanwhile,
did you wait tables?
No, I never did.
Yeah.
It was such a rare and wonderful gift to have here. What it used to be in the days of Olivier and Gielgud and those guys, you'd finish drama school and you'd go off to a rep company to Birmingham or wherever, and you would learn. You would do rep. You would do a lot of plays. And that's what we did. I did 4 years of play. We would do a little season in New York, spend the rest of the year touring. And there's just no experience like it. You just really learn stuff, whether you like it or not. But I finally had to leave that and sort of take on the responsibility of a proper career outside the acting company. So I did nothing for 9 months. I was starving. I was doing off Broadway. They would pay me subway fare. You know, this they pay for my subway. In those days, you would invite an agent to come and see you in your showcase production. Yes. At this
showcasing. Yeah.
And that, on Van Damme Street. Yeah, yes. That's where I would showcase. Van Damme Street.
I can't even remember. I don't think the street had a name where I was performing.
Street.
But
I did a bunch of them.
I got a job standing by for Raoul Julia in Threepenny Opera, which was fantastic because I had to watch it every night. It was a wonderful production, directed by Richard Foreman, and I loved Raoul. Anyway, he never got sick. I never went on. My point is that I also, having sworn never to do a commercial or a soap opera, I got a part in a soap opera.
Search for Tomorrow.
And you played?
I played Woody Reed. And I owned a modeling agency for only the most ulterior of motives, surrounded by beautiful women.
And they needed your guidance.
I took them under my wing, as it were. Heinous character, but I remember saying the first day, I say, please, can we come up with another name? Because I have to say my name. And to say Woody Reed. It's going to come out Reedy Wood or Woodwind Flatulent or what? Woody Reed is just a hideous name. I say, no, that's your name. Okay. So I did that for 1 year, and it was great because I worked about once a week, and I was could continue doing my off Broadways and standing by for Raoul and that kind of thing. And then I got a part in a musical, and the rest is history. Which
Hector
was
MacArthur.
A Hector MacArthur. Well, yeah, and a bunch of people. It was a musical based on a play that you did magnificently.
Yes. I Close the Iron Door on
I
you.
Close the Iron Door. And John Barrymore played this character on film with Carol Lombard. It was called 20th Century, a brilliant film. Thank you. And this was a musical version that Hal Prince directed. Comden and Green wrote the book and lyrics. Cy Coleman wrote the music and... Madeleine Kahn and John Cullum were
the leads. No, in the play...
And I did a little nothing
in the play, the Oscar and Lily Garland, they are, in the musical, more featured than her young Lothario. And in the musical, it's different. In the musical, your part is a big... The part you played, the young boyfriend.
Yes.
And that was a huge part of the musical.
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't.
It became a huge part.
Do tell.
Well, it was a nothing part. A friend of mine had turned down. My agent told me to turn it down. I turned it down. But when I was delivering the script back, Joanna Merlin, who was Hal Prince, who's a wonderful actress and a brilliant casting director, said, oh, are you sure you don't want to do this? Because it'd be a great, you'd be part of the family and the part could grow in rehearsals. You know, you never know. Well, okay, I'll try it. And I did it and the part did grow. And thanks to Madeleine Kahn, who... Another actress might have said, the guy who's doing all the shtick and bouncing off the walls and doing all this stuff that's not written, could you fire him, please? She didn't. In fact, she said, let's develop this. And we developed all this stuff, and then we took the show out of town, and Cy Coleman wrote a song for me to do a duet. It grew and grew and grew, and I won a Tony Award.
And it was who was Oscar in that?
John Cullum.
Cullum.
He was brilliant.
Yeah. And you did that for how long?
1 year.
1 year.
And right after I won the Tony, I left. They said, are you crazy? You just won a Tony. How can you leave? I said, well, there's this great part in this wonderful Michael Weller play they're doing down at the Arena stage in Washington. I said, wait a minute. You're leaving New York to go to the
your Tony Award winning
performance?
To go do?
Loose Ends. It was a play called Loose Ends.
Right.
And I loved the play. And Alan Schneider directed it. And then it moved to Broadway. And I did it for 9 months. But I was told I was crazy to do that.
But does that become a guiding principle for you that you want to go do what you want to do that excites you? And, you know, after you win the Tony, it's like, we're done.
Yeah, I'd say it's a combination of doing what I want and being talked into things. Making the most of them.
Have you ever been talked into? I can pour and talk at the same time.
Look at that.
Have you ever been talked into things?
Many things, yeah.
What's an example of something you were talked into?
Well, where people would say, oh, no, you've got to do that. You've got to. It's only 4 weeks. And you know, like Pirates of Penzance, I had done. I'd done this very physical comedy on the 20th Century. And then I went off and did this serious Michael Weller play for a year. And then, I was offered this silly Gilbert and Sullivan. I wasn't a huge Gilbert and Sullivan fan. And I was riding through the park on my then girlfriend's bicycle. And it was a beautiful day. And I thought, oh, 4 weeks in the park. What, you know, how bad can it be? I was riding my bike to my agent's in order to turn it down. The part had originally been offered to Raul Julia. And Raul had to leave to go to Francis Coppola's Zoetrope company. He had a rep company. Remember when he had that, when he first started Zoetrope, he had this fledgling repertory company. So Raul had to bow out. So suddenly the part was open. And anyway, I said, okay, I'll do it 4 weeks. What the hell? And then it moved to Broadway for a year. And then we made a movie of it.
And did you win another Tony?
Oh, yeah. But it was a combination of it being a beautiful day and my agent saying, come on, it's 4 weeks. Well, why not? It won't kill you.
And that's the first time you met Joe? So the beginning of your relationship with Joe?
Yes. Well, I had met him because I carried a spear one summer before I ever started Juilliard. I came up early before September and got a job carrying a spear and other items and actors. I carried Charles Durning once with seven other guys on a beer. Anyway, several beers. Any case, long story short, it's too late for that. Never mind. What?
Joe.
Yeah. I met him when I was standing by for Raul Julia. I met him, but then when I did Pirates, then I met him and he kept saying, nice to meet you. And I was like, I didn't want to tell him that I'd met him.
Sure.
But yeah, that's when I started.
I assumed that was when he really met you and really got to know you.
Yeah.
Hey, Alex, who is Joe?
Oh, Joe Papp. And describe what he was like when you first worked with him.
Well, I love Joe.
Of course.
I miss him every day. He became a mentor and a kind of strict but loving father, guide, mentor. And I remember he came to the dress rehearsal and Wilfred Leach, the director, said, now Joe's probably going to give you all notes. Be sure to ignore them. And Joe said to me after the run, he said, you know, the pirates, these are all gentlemen. They're peers of the realm, you know, so it's all, they're very sophisticated. They're not goofballs, you know. And I went, that's all I'm doing is goofball, you know.
That's all I got.
So I went to the director and to Graziella Danielle, the choreographer. I said, Joe says that the guy this should be gentlemanly and dignified. They said, I told you not to listen to Joe. You know, because Joe, he was right. But we had sort of gone another direction. Joe was great. The one thing, sometimes the notes you had to take, but you know, any actor who's had enough experience knows to take any note from your director, from your best friend, from your wife, from your fellow actor. Take it all with a grain of salt. I remember John Travolta called when they announced we're going to make a movie of Pirates of Penzance. John Travolta, apparently, I heard, called Joe and said, I want to play the Pirate King. And Joe said, we have our Pirate King. That was Joe. Joe was utterly loyal and demanded loyalty and got it. And I would, whether it was whatever play, opening night, he'd come backstage and say, okay, so next year, what's it going to be? Are you ready to do Richard II or Hamlet, or what do you want to do next? And he'd sort of exact a commitment. And I needed that.
And how soon after you do Pirates do you go to make your first films?
Right after that.
Right after.
Pirates of Penzance. We were still running it on Broadway, and Alan Pakula offered me the part in Sophie's Choice. And he said it was something he saw in Pirates of Penzance that made him want to cast me. And I wasn't about to talk him out of it, but I thought, what an imagination. Yeah. And he was I couldn't have had a better first director for a movie. He totally indulged the actors. The actors, we came on the set first thing in the morning. There's no crew. There's no shot that's been designed. It's like, what do you want to do? Show me where you want to go. And then he'd bring Nestor Almendros, one of the great cinematographers, and the rest of the crew, okay, watch this. And then we'd do what we wanted.
Did you know Meryl before that?
No.
You met her on that film?
I met her once. She came backstage after Pirates of Penzance, in fact. I think that's where I met her.
And did you, I mean, you'd done the soap.
Yes.
You'd done no TV, other TV. You'd only done the soap.
Yes.
And so when you're on the set, Bakula, Nestor, had Meryl been making a lot of films by then?
She'd just done the French Lieutenant's Woman. And Kramer versus Kramer and a couple of others, but that was her first her most recent.
Right. She'd done Manhattan. Small roles.
Yeah.
And so when you do this film, are you sitting there saying to yourself, I've got to learn how to act differently in front of a camera?
Well, I remember Graciela Daniel, the choreographer for Pirates, because when we were, as I said, the show was still going on, Pirates, she said, you know, you can't do that, all that face stuff you do on film. You can't make those faces. Okay. And other people had said, you know, it's film acting is completely different from stage acting. I said, oh, no. Oh, dear. Well, okay. I'll just give it a shot. But I learned after a while that acting is acting. The audience is much closer on film, and in fact, you can do more in some ways on film that you can't do in the theater, because the first row wouldn't even hear you. But
it was an adjustment for you.
Yeah.
Well, because I'm not saying this to be just flattering. I mean, you are someone who's done both at the highest level. You've given great, great performances in films, and you've given great, great performances in the theater. But was it tough for you? Was it difficult for you?
No.
No.
I mean, it was scary because I thought, what if everything I've learned in the last, 10 years of acting professionally on stage, if it's not applicable, it's up to the whole new skill set I have to learn. It's going to be pretty daunting. But no, it was... And Pakula said, think of filmmaking as rehearsal, where you try it a bunch of different times, and then I'm going to pick the best one. But that's what rehearsing is, and each day you work on a scene or two of a play. In the film, you shoot a scene or two of the thing, and you work on it and do it a few times, and you trust the director. And he invited me to dailies.
Did you find that helpful?
Totally. And I am always taken aback when certain insecure directors don't want the actors to come to dailies, because the first day I went, I saw, first of all, the way I was being lit was brilliant. I mean, that's the character, I thought. And then I would go to Pakula and I'd say, okay, it was the first take of the first take for the beginning was good, and then right in the middle it was like take
three. He invited you to say that?
Take three, right? For the middle part, and the ending I thought worked best in take four, and he said, I totally agree. And then I knew that we were on the same page, as it were, and that what I was seeing and what he was seeing, that we were all in sync, that we were, it was great. Actually, Meryl was a tremendous help. I remember once I was making a huge meal out of just me doing, I had to give Stingo, the character's name, I had to give him some money because he'd been robbed. And I was doing, you know, you're a writer, you need this money and blah, blah, blah. And I was just emoting. And she said, just give him money. No, and just, or you can just say it, you know, just say it. You don't have to. And so, yeah, I guess I was doing too much.
I know I certainly was.
But I was helped by Pakula and Meryl.
And what a great thing to have your first movie with a great director like Pakula.
Oh, God, he was so such a spoiler.
Who were some of the other directors, even in the theater, that helped you?
Well, Jerry Friedman directed my class in School for Scandal when we were still at Juilliard, and then it went into our repertory. And then years later, he directed Blythe Danner and me in Much Ado About Nothing in the Park. He was a wonderful director, I learned. He was the first one, like Pakula. Pakula did the same thing in terms of empowering the actor. Pakula would say to me, "Look, whatever we've talked about in this scene, or what we think it's about, or what you know, what could happen, if you get a different impulse during that scene, forget what I said." Forget what we planned. You follow your impulses. The character was a psychopath and had to be unpredictable, and he wanted it to be as spontaneous as possible. And then again, I was blessed with Meryl, who Meryl said, don't be afraid you're going to hurt me, because a lot of it was very physical. She said, you can't, which I took as a challenge, of course. But she was right. And Pakula said, do what you want. And the same way Jerry Friedman in the theater was the first director to say, okay, we're just going to sit around the table and read it, and when you feel like moving, get up and move. And pretty soon the tables are cleared away and we're moving around, and we're moving when we want to move. We're not waiting for the director to say, okay, now walk over there. Now put your hand in your pocket. Now say it this way. Now do, that's what, and he was the first, and it was that empowerment. It's like, you decide. What does this mean to you? How do you want to do this? And that was the key to for me, both in stage and film. And those directors, the directors I love, Larry Kasdan is the same way. Larry's.
How many movies have you made with Kasdan? Why? What about him?
He lets you contribute. He doesn't tell you what to do. He wants to see what you're going to do, and he'll guide you back to the road if you've strayed too far afield and make a suggestion. But he loves actors. Peter Bogdanovich told me a story about was it Howard Hawks or John Ford who directed Big River, whoever did. John Wayne was saying, hey, this guy Montgomery Clift, this new kid, he's got these big emotional scenes, and I've only got a couple of lines here, and I need some other big scenes. And he said, Duke, you need three good moments in a film. The rest of the time, you just try not to annoy the audience.
Kevin Kline has nailed that advice. Coming up, how he almost missed his surprise Oscar win and why his mom wasn't going to let that happen. Explore the Here's the Thing archives. I speak with Julianne Moore, who also spent some of her early years working on a soap opera.
I used to do what they called emotional applique, where if I had to say something that was really just plot-oriented, I'd try to, like, cry on top of it or laugh on top of it or anything just to make it mean something.
Sure.
Right?
Sure. Take a listen at heresthething.org. We'll be right back.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Few big-name actors manage to avoid Hollywood typecasting. But my guest today, Kevin Klein, has that rare power to reinvent himself and delight audiences in the process. Compare his early role in Sophie's Choice with a later one like A Fish Called Wanda.
You know, once you start making movies or become a big star on Broadway or whatever it is, and you're offered things and don't have to audition anymore, it's a terrible burden. Well, it's a great luxury.
It is, it really is.
No, but in drama school, you're assigned, or in the early days of movies, you were assigned a role. You're going to play Rhett Butler in Gone with the Wind. Well, all right. You know, and you just did it and did what you were told. But now, you want to do this or you want to do that? You want to do this? You want to do that? I don't know. You have to choose.
And have people that can counsel you and advise you. What's the movie like? Did you start to get excited about being in movies and go, oh, God, I'm so excited? What's one that you just said, God, I'm so excited I'm doing this movie?
Sophie's Choice.
Sophie's Choice.
Yeah, it was my first, and it was like insane. Right. I was like, I can't believe this is unbelievable. I didn't have to start being the pizza delivery guy with one line and work my way up. I just was boom, hit the ground running. I mean, I'd been toiling desperately in the theater for 10 years, and God rest his soul and God love him, Alan Pakula wanted an unknown. He didn't want any baggage. He wanted someone that you couldn't predict what they were going to do. I said, well, that's me. No, no one knows who the hell I am.
What do you think people hire you for?
It's very tricky that. Sometimes you become suspicious that it's for the wrong reasons. Because now the way the movie business works a lot of times is can we use your name? Will you attach yourself to this movie? In the old days, like, the movie's green lit, it's happening, you're offered a part, yes, no, okay. Now it's, will you attach yourself to this movie? And then if we get another few people to attach themselves and they have a certain amount of guaranteed box office revenue in foreign sales, blah, 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 we will be able to raise the money to make this movie. Okay, so a lot of times I think, well, they obviously just need some... They just need me for that. I'm not right for this part. They don't like my work. They hate me. They don't care about me. They don't love me.
But it's like that with us. You're in meetings now because the business is completely overtaken now by non-creative people. They don't have any background as writers or, you know, whatever, as producers. So everything is about gaming it. I mean, the joke in Hollywood is you're having a meeting with them about, you know, the biography of Thomas Jefferson. And they said, well, who's going to play Sally Hemings? And they're like, well, Sandra Bullock is going to play Sally Hemings. I mean, who else could there be that could play? You know what I mean? It's so cynical that way.
When I did the movie Dave,
I loved that movie.
Me too. I loved that movie. And I, of course, I turned it down first, but I was I was talked into it, and I'm glad I was. But Ivan Reitman told me, he said, the studio's pressuring me to use Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I tried to explain to them that if you're Austrian, you cannot be the president of the United States. Of course, the irony is, years later, he became governor of California and probably could have run for president and may still, who knows. But... he just thought it was, he had to kind of force me on the studio, and I'm glad he did.
Now, a movie, I'm sorry?
A Fish Named Wanda.
It's actually A Fish Called Wanda, right?
Yes, because okay. the British
try to get the titles right when you shout out. When you're expressing love and admiration for Mr. Klein.
I knew exactly what you meant.
Try to get the correct title, please.
Yeah.
A Fish Called Wanda.
Right. Which to an American ear sounds like, well, how did the fish know how to use a telephone? Why would they, you know? No. But that's a British, you know, locution. But anyway, A Fish Called Wanda. That part was written for me.
By?
John Cleese.
He wrote it. Had you known him before?
Yeah, yeah.
You know him?
Yeah, I knew him. We'd met many times over the years, and we'd always have dinner, and we'd talk, and then he did a little part in Silverado. And we actually shared a house for the couple of weeks that he worked. And it was there when he told me, he said, I'm thinking of a film, an idea, and I'll... And he actually told me, he said, a year or so later when he wrote the first draft, and he said, I've written something for you where you are the most evil person in the world and you are run over by a steamroller and you eat Michael Palin's tropical fish. I said, sounds great. let's do it. Never thinking it would ever get made or anything.
And you won an Oscar for that film.
I did.
No. Did you have an idea that you were going to win?
Pardon me?
Did you think you were going to win?
Oh, God, no.
You didn't?
Not for a moment. Mm-hmm. I was actually rehearsing I Love You to Death in L.A. At the time. Yeah, that's the problem, you see. A smattering. Not that big a hit, but a wonderful movie. And I was working on my Italian accent for the role. And the Oscars were coming up, and I was just very ensconced in that, trying to master an Italian accent. And then I said, I'm just going to stay home and work on my accent, because we start shooting in 4 days, whatever. I'm not going to go to the Oscars. Everyone tells me I'm not going to win. Apparently, people who are following the odds makers or whatever said, you're not even a dark horse. You know, they're like... Oh, and Kevin Klein, never mind. And I'm rehearsing with River Phoenix, who's nominated also for Running on Empty. We're in the same category. And he's so, God, he was so sweet. I hope you win. You're so great in this movie. But anyway, so I'm nominated. I call my home, and my mother says, we're all gathered around the TV tomorrow night to watch. And I say, Mom, I'm not going. I got a lot of work to do. I'm doing this, and I'm not going to win. And it's a long evening, so I'm not going to go. She said, who do you think you are? You'll go.
You get right out there, young man.
Exactly.
And you put on that tuxedo.
That was okay, I'll go. And then I won.
You were stunned when they said your name.
I was stunned.
That's a great story.
No.
That's great.
It's a strange thing. I remember I was presented the award by Sean Connery, Michael Caine, and there were three Brits, and Roger Moore. And they were all there presenting and doing Brit jokes, you know, and then they said, and the winner is Kevin Connery. And then they kind of ushered me off stage, and I just said the F word about 20 times. And I thought, why am I cursing? This is like, A, I couldn't believe it. B, it was, there was no contempt.
You said it on camera?
No. In the
wings. As you're walking up.
But I thought, they must think I'm completely insane, because I just kept saying, it just was a catch-all word that covered a myriad of emotions, from contempt to disgrace.
You had Oscar-induced Tourette syndrome, is what you had there. Like,
yeah,
you just scream out, "Fuck!"
I didn't know what it meant, and then I learned later on it meant nothing, that people, Oscar winner Kevin Klein, and that was it. But it didn't change. Oh, didn't it change your career? No. Were you offered more comedy roles? Yes, but I was being offered more comedy roles because I did A Fish Called Wanda, not because I won an Oscar for it.
But right after you won the Oscar, what did you go shoot right after that? What movies did you make right after?
The one that I'd rather not discuss. Then I did I Love You to Death.
And the one you'd rather not discuss because you just didn't like making the movie. It wasn't fun.
It was called The January Man. It wasn't fun.
Okay.
Because I thought it was a comedy, and I don't think the director did. And I didn't realize that until halfway through. No, it was a John Patton.
So everyone did an operating move, and you're going, you know.
Yeah, you're, what are you doing?
You're like, wait, oh, I'm a doctor, but I thought. But anyway, you.
It was a John Patrick Shanley script, and Shanley is ironic and, you know.
Funny.
Everything's, and funny. So I saw the whole thing as a satire, and the director, we talked about it before doing it, and I thought it didn't.
What did you do after that?
I Love You to Death. Yeah. Right. Which was the most fun.
Why?
Maybe I've ever had. Oh, my God. It was a brilliantly funny script based on a true story of a guy who's white. You didn't see it?
I've seen Love You to Death. Yeah.
Who
directed the film?
Lawrence Kasdan.
It was another Kasdan film. Have you ever written any films or written any scripts?
No. Rewrite. I do. No, because we were talking earlier about both of us having worked on a soap opera, that someone told me about the second week, said, you don't have to say the lines that are written. You can rewrite any of this. No one cares. Okay. And I started to learn. I would, because these lines were unutterably inutterable, awful, horrible. So I did a lot of rewriting. I learned a lot about rewriting. And now, and I'm sure you feel the same way, not only with comedies, but, and it started with Sophie's Choice. Meryl said, are you saying the lines as written? And I said, yeah. She said, you don't have to. If it doesn't fit in your mouth, you know, and if it's, you can, she saw me worrying about saying the line right, you know, and getting it the word perfect. And I was used to 4 or 5 weeks of rehearsal. We had 3 weeks of rehearsal for Sophie's Choice, but Meryl didn't want to rehearse. She wanted, well, let's just talk. Let's have it happen while the camera's running. Well, that's interesting, but I didn't have that repetition that you get in rehearsals. So the lines, so she saw that I was struggling to, she'd just say, you know what you're saying. You can put it in your own words.
One of my favorite films of yours, I mean, one of them, I mean, there's a few. One of my favorite films of yours is In and Out. I love that movie. I love that movie.
Thank you.
Was that a good experience for you?
Yeah, it was a great experience. It was, yeah, great fun. And, I mean, Frank Oz was terrific as a director. Joan Cusack.
She's priceless. She's priceless.
Yeah, just amazing. Everyone. And Tom Selleck. Everyone was a delight. It was most fun. And on, except for rare occasions, Frank Oz was that kind of, my favorite kind of director. Like, show me what you want to do here. He let us do our thing.
Are we, am I mistaken? I don't think we're mistaken. Are we going to take some questions here? Is that right?
What's coming up next?
Do we have a mic? Do we have mics for people? You just want to yell.
What's coming up next?
Raise your hand if you have a question. Who said what's coming up next? Okay.
That's my
stand
agent.
Up, please. And you want to know for what's coming up next for Kevin. Here we go. Kevin, what's coming up next? Did I say that right?
Nothing. Don't know. I'll be reading a script in the car home. And my agent wants me to call him right after I finish it. Because they're offering me a huge payday.
Another question for Kevin. Thank you very much, sir. Thank you. Another question for Kevin.
I've always loved your comedy. And I was a fan of Pythons and John Cleese. And you said that John Cleese wrote that part for you. You know, just scraps on it. How was it working with him? Was there a dynamic between the English humor and, you know, your humor?
No, and I remember I had a friend, a producer friend, said, you're going to do a movie with John Cleese and Michael Palin from the... I mean, that's very British humor. It's not the same as our humor. And I said, I don't care. I mean, first of all, I don't believe in... I think humor is humor. What's funny is universally funny if it's human. And I adored Monty Python. For me, the opportunity to work with Michael Palin and John Cleese, I don't care if anyone sees it or or if it sucks. I want that experience. There was no question about doing it. Didn't know it was going to be a big hit. didn't know while making it that it was going to be a hit of any kind. All I knew is it was great fun to do. And my favorite day, I think, on the set was one day when I got to direct John and Michael in a scene. I wasn't even in the scene. But by directing, all I did was, remember in rehearsals, you did this, it was much slower and it was much more excruciating when you're trying to get him to say Cathcart Towers. And I think you're rushing. But if you slow down, and he did, and it's in the movie, and I directed John Cleese and Michael Palin in comedy acting. That was fun.
I wanted to say a couple quick things because we're out of time, and that is thank you to Kevin for making the time, because I'm under the impression you don't do a lot of this, and no, but I mean, like, a lot of press.
No, I don't. Like, I hate interviews. Yeah, I don't like them at all.
Yeah. But I want to say that in my lifetime, it's always the same thing comes back to me, and as the people I've observed that I admire, and you are, you know, surely one of the most admired actors in my lifetime in this business. And I want to say, that the people who are great, like, you can't be great. You just can't. You can be good if you have two of these. I mean, you can't be great if you have one of these, but if you have two of these traits, you can be good, but you can't be great. But you can really be great if you have all three of these traits for men, and that is masculinity, intelligence, and sensitivity. And you exhibit all those things in all the films that you've made, and you're really great. It's really a pleasure to watch your career.
What was the middle thing?
What was the middle thing?
Yeah. It was intelligence, what?
I'm going to write
masculinity,
it down for you backstage.
Intelligence.
Sensitivity,
that's it,
and
sorry.
Intelligence. Kevin Kline, everybody.
Thank you so much, Alec. Thank you all very much.
Kevin Kline, we want more of you. Here's hoping that script you read in the car will give us that opportunity. Thanks to everyone at the Two River Theater in Red Bank, New Jersey, for making this possible. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.